Welcome to The Apple of Truth, a podcast that, despite our original intentions, has grown into pure Neil Gaiman appreciation.
So let us take you on a journey through everything Neil himself has ever written.
Currently, we are covering The Sandman and hope to enrich your dreams and haunt your nightmares.
I'm Vero.
And I'm Lina.
And this is Season 1, Episode 5, 24/7. But before we get into the episode, we need to welcome our newest patron, Alex, that joined on the Believer level. If you want to be like Alex and also enjoy the extra special bonus content that comes with being a Believer, go to patreon.com/TAOTpodcast.
So, Alex believes in us. Wow!
Woohoo!
Just like John believes in the ruby and Morpheus.
Yikes.
Beliefs in dreams and hopes.
Okay, why don't we kick off with you telling us what this was about?
Well, this episode is about John trying to save the world only to lose it all, and at the end, Dream finally recovers all of his power when a new character shows face. Ah.
Okay, thirsty times. I will say one thing. Dream was not in this episode enough for me to choose a moment. So this is the first time since we started doing Sandman that I'm not choosing one of his moments.
I got a Dream moment.
Oh, wow. So we swapped. Nice.
Yep.
I had to be very biased in this episode and choose the hottest moment to be Judy, period, the whole time.
Because really?
She is played by Daisy Head and she is one of the most beautiful beings in the world, in my opinion. So she was very much doing that for me. And also, I mean, there is a lot of faults and stresses in this episode, and we'll talk about the details as we go through it. But I felt for her the most, I feel like.
Oh, wow.
So that's okay. Why I'm choosing her.
Okay. Curious. So my hottest dream moment, like you said, there is not really a lot of dream in this, but there is also not a lot of hot moments or hot people in general in this. So I had a bit of a hard time picking any kind of thing. And then, of course, thankfully, we come to the end of the episode and Dream puts John to bed.
Oh, yeah.
With his hand on the back of his head. And he says, "Sleep well, John." And that is just so much daddy energy that it made me nearly forgot the atrocious visual of ginormous Morpheus holding tiny John in his head, because that will fucking give me nightmares.
I don't blame you with either of those things, because yes, you are actually correct now that I'm thinking back at it. That was definitely the hottest dream moment in the episode. I don't know why I didn't write that down.
Because you have not the same obsession as I do with daddy energy.
Yeah, I do have a little bit of a more of an obsession with Daisy Head, apparently. But
no, you like him broody and I like him competent. And so daddy is the definition of competence.
That feels like it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive, though.
It doesn't have to, but most of the time it is.
Okay. Especially in this show, it seems like.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about it, but he definitely does seem a bit more competent. But before we go into any of that, we have to go through the facts and funs. It is the last episode for Jamie Childs, director. Next time we get someone else. Writer is Amani Rosa, who also wrote for Yellow Jackets, which is still on my list of shows I need to watch.
Mm-hmm.
The episode adapts issues number 6 and 7 from the comics, and those issues are called 24 Hours and Sound and Fury. Episode title 24/7 kinda combines that, but me being me, I'm still hung up on the fact that every title of every episode is a song title, and this obviously being no different. 24/7 is a song by Selena Sharma and Harris J, and it is about someone who is obsessed with the significant other with whom they used to be so casual. And in my opinion, it's quite easy to put John and the Ruby into this. I quote, "I try to quit, but truth is I don't want to. Yeah, cause 24/7 I'm thinking about you."
Okay, well, This episode actually does give us a song.
I know.
Very well chosen. So we will talk about that one when we get to it.
Okay, then I will not mention it right now.
Oh, you can. I did find the name and the artist and just put that in my notes just so I have it for safekeeping if we decide to get more
into details. Are you talking
about
the song playing when John enters the diner?
No. I'm talking about the song playing in the scene where everybody starts fucking.
The music playing as John Dee enters the diner is Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, which coincidentally is the same that is being played when Andy in the Shawshank Redemption plays music. And having a marriage song come in is also kind of fitting with John and his obsession with the ruby, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Especially since it seems in that moment that he doesn't even realize he walked into a diner. And then lastly, the character John Dee shares his name with an infamous Elizabethan astrologer and occultist, and it's also a character carried over from the Justice League and Swamp Thing comics. So
interesting.
There is much more to John Dee than one might think. And that concludes the Facts and Funs, a short one this time.
Lovely. This episode is very single focused, and so is my previously on the Sandman.
I hope it's only about John.
No. Dream got imprisoned and robbed by Roderick, who spawned John with Ethel. Ethel robbed Roderick of Dream's items of power, and John took the ruby off of her. And boy, did it fuck him up. He ended up in a facility out of which he broke free, and he finally got his ruby back. Yes, I say his ruby, because Dream tried to reclaim it, but for some reason, it now belongs to John.
We start off right where we left. We are in the storage container, basically. And Matthew pecking at Dream was somehow absolutely hilarious to me. And we also get a fuck drop here because Matthew says, wake the fuck up, which I think is the first time I noticed a fuck being used in a Netflix show.
And it is not the last time.
Yeah, but usually I never register on it. So I was like, ah, I got it this time. So I was very proud of myself. But yeah, poor Bibi Dream is completely knocked the fuck out. Because later we learn that the ruby not only did reject him, it also took more of his power.
True. So John walks into a diner. And I know this starts like a bad joke.
Yes. A man in pajama walks into a diner while The Marriage of Figaro plays.
And he ignores the sign, please wait to be seated, because as we soon learn, Bette is her name. Bette says, sit anywhere you like.
Also, he's busy staring at the ruby, so I think he didn't even see the sign. Most of the time, I don't think John is being deliberately rude. He's just very distracted.
She did say, sit wherever you like. I think that would be somewhat the ruby's fault, because she does sit everybody else down except for John. But he comes and sits down, and he has a view of the entire diner, which...
Best seat in the house.
Best seat in the house. Now, we have a couple of different things that happen at the beginning. First, we can hear the broadcast. It feels like a quite prominent little details, so I try to pay attention to what was said there and how that progressed.
I completely ignored it. I am very much here for the fact that you paid active attention to it, because I completely didn't.
So we start with everything is fine, except there is a bit of a traffic jam because there was an accident with two semi-trucks that were moving some sort of a toxic material, but luckily nothing escaped. Just take a detour. Everything is fine. So this feels like a very, nothing bad is happening, everything is fine. Now we get the introduction of Bette. What did you think of her at the beginning?
I really, really loved Bette, because she is being more than just the usual waitress kind to John. She actually seems to be actively kind to him, which of course later on makes a lot of sense when she is being honest that she just wants people to like her.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it when she goes, honesty is the best policy, and John going, people do say that, huh? I was very much here for the interaction between the two of them.
Yeah.
She does go through quite a few stages throughout the episode, though.
True. Yeah, same myself at the beginning. I was like, I love that. She is clearly very good at her job. And, you know, she seems actually genuinely kind and nice. They start having a conversation about the ruby. He shows her the ruby because he's John and he doesn't care, nor he is afraid that it will be taken away from him because he altered the ruby.
Also, she asked him, like, what changed his life, basically. Like, what made him feel better than he has in a long time. And he goes, this is.
Question, answer. Simple as that.
At least with John, it is really that simple.
Yeah. As long as you're doing what he wants you to do.
As long as you don't lie. I don't even think you have to do what he wants you to do. You have to be 100% honest. And humanity, like, our social interaction doesn't work if we are 100% honest. If we are 100% honest.
Which we will learn.
Yeah, I mean, that is like one of the classic things. But
yeah,
in the beginning, all seems really nice. But obviously, because this is John, every single scene that happens within the diner has this tension to it, even right from the beginning. I'm pretty sure it has a lot to do with the camera work, because there is always this light tilt to it. It's never, in the beginning, it's not a full Dutch angle, but you do have some distortion still happening on the sides. The angles feel unnatural. So it's not the usual framing that you get. You have a lot of weird, over-exaggerated close-ups of faces most of the times, even before anything is happening, and just keeps getting worse. So camera work-wise, this episode is the worst, in quotation marks, so far, because it makes you feel the most unpleasant by just watching it. And I'm curious if now that Dream has all his tools back and everything, if we're going to get a less tense setting when it comes to that.
That's a good question. Now, we start getting a little bit more of a background on the characters that we're going to spend the entire episode with. Beth offers coffee to her chef, while the chef is like, no, I'm just finishing a double, so Marsh is going to be in a second. And Beth's face immediately changes and she goes to the bathroom
to freshen up.
I first was like, well, she could be just, you know, not feeling well or something. This is where I started guessing what's wrong and what's the relationship between her and Marsh. Did not see coming what actually happened.
That he's fucking her son, who thankfully is 21, because when he first said that, I was like, oh no, oh no. Oh, yeah. Okay, he's 21.
Yeah, that was a big one. But at this point, my theory was that they got together for a one night and now she's pregnant.
Oh my God.
He doesn't want to have anything to do with her. So that was my expectation. And that's why I assumed that she was so nervous and putting on lipstick.
And here I thought that she just had the hots for him, but so far had not gotten him to, like, acknowledge her existence. That he has been coming to her home and that she has been cooking for him and that he has been hanging out with her son. Did not see that coming. I thought they were still in the stage of her being coy and shy and everything. But no.
Nope.
She was trying to take it to the next level, from him coming over to her place and her cooking for him to the two of them making out.
The first time the bell at the door rings and we have our first outside character coming in.
Judy!
It's Judy / Daisy Head.
I wrote down, Judy seems familiar, and then I forgot to look her up.
Daisy Head is the daughter of Anthony Head, who some of you might know from Buffy or Ted Lasso or a billion other things, or Marilyn. And she is on a lot of things these days. She has made her name in the D&D movie and on Shadow and Bone, where she is absolutely incredible in both of these. And I knew that Daisy is going to be in one of the episodes of The Sandman, but that was all the information that I had. I did not look at any spoilers. I didn't look at any pictures, even though people were talking about it around me, because I love Shadow and Bone, obviously. And people would only watch this specific episode because they knew Daisy was in it. So I didn't even know which episode she's in. I just knew she was in one. So when she showed up, I got really excited because I find her very, very good at acting, and she is very good to look at from aesthetic, but also from a professional point of view. So I was very excited because I knew this was going to be a very good episode from the get-go. Now, the character that she portrays, Judy, that was unexpected to me.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, not in a bad sense, but it was a pleasant surprise to see her in something different, because she is such a good actor that she doesn't really have a style or a type that she would be cast in. And her accent was very good. It was very pleasant for me. It didn't, because I know that we talked about Rosemary, or I talked about Rosemary in the previous episode, that her accent just wasn't cutting it for me. It was a little distracting. Daisy did a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening for it. But also the whole storyline with Donna, I was really intrigued. I knew from the beginning there was something that was going on that she wasn't telling anybody, and I really wanted to know what it was, which to me is a sign of good acting and good story writing.
Nothing about Judy and her relationship came as a surprise to me, to be honest. So, but it was good. Once we have Judy, it starts that literally everyone at any moment is just the most tense. Like, it is not just the camera work, it's not just the angles. Every performance, every character has this inherent tenseness to them. And we've talked about this before, that literally every John scene makes you tense. And since this is a John episode, obviously everything has to make you even more tense. And I found it very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. As I said, we are starting to learn a little bit more about the characters. And Beth is picking up the goss, let's put it that way. Because
she's very nosy, yes. She needs to know everything, and she clearly wants to be involved in everything. She's a fixer. She's a matchmaker. She's a fixer. She's a meddler.
This is the first time when I actually start not really loving her behavior. Because she eavesdrops on Judy's phone call. Or video call with her friend Rose. And she goes to the kitchen and starts speaking at Marsh.
Mm-hmm.
She's not having a conversation.
She speaks at him. That is very accurate. Because she says, another fight.
Yes. So this is not the first time something happened between Judy and Donna.
Also, the way the friend on the phone reacts to Judy looking for Donna, and Donna being like, tell me where she is, and the friend going like, I really don't know, instantly gave me off the vibe of the, I did something that would make her friends lie to me if I was looking for her.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why her hitting Donna came not as a surprise to me.
Okay.
Because that is literally the classic with the, why would I not believe my friend if my friend tells me they don't know where my partner is? And the only reason I would have to not believe is if I fucked up on a level that would make it acceptable, in quotation marks, for them to lie to me. And so I was either cheating or physical violence. Like, those two were my go-to options.
When you put it that way, yes. I didn't pick up on that myself, but yes, you're right.
Because this episode is so tight, there had to be a reason why we got the phone conversation in that length, and not just a short, oh, I overheard this, and then Beth can use it to try to talk at Marsh. And that is why I paid attention to it.
So Marsh is completely ignoring Beth, and it seems very uncomfortable.
It's so cringy. I hated that. It made me so uncomfortable. It makes sense, but it was not good for me.
No. But then she says something that actually makes me very unhappy with Beth, because she starts judging Judy's choice of a partner. And she says she could have any man in town. And I'm like, I'm sorry, we haven't had the explicit I am gay just yet, but she is dating a woman that has been cleared. Why would she want to date a man? Like, why is that a thing that Beth has the need to say? And this is where I felt a lot of judgment coming from her. And I did not like it.
Yeah, she is a busybody. She is a matchmaker. And I think she has no experience in matchmaking queer relationships. So give me the things I know I'm used to.
Yeah. And just to confirm this eek kind of a moment, the bell with the door rings yet again, and the young boy walks in the suit.
Yes, Mr. Mistopheles. So the actor played Mr. Mistopheles in the Horrible Cats movie. We talked about this in the bonus. Be a believer like Alex, and then you can listen to it.
Woo.
Because I also wrote down, suit guy also looks familiar. And then I didn't look it up until previously when we talked about it. He walks in and Beth once again is being very charming, very sweet with him, because obviously he's very nervous and he's like, oh, I'm just too early for an interview. Is it okay if I just have coffee? Which classic thing with the, oh no, I am that much too early that I cannot show up to showcase that I'm trying to be good and be slightly early for an appointment, but I'm that much early that I will make a fool out of myself if I show up now. And I say that as someone who's had very amusing interview moments with applicants showing up or walking into the yard, checking out where the door is and then going away again, not realizing that where I was sitting, I had perfect view of them showing up and like canvassing.
No! So, I would totally do that. I have done that, actually.
It makes so much sense because it's like, oh no, like you have to go to the back building. And like, of course you want to make sure, because what if it is more complicated and it's going to take more time? So
exactly.
Yeah, I feel Mark. I feel Mark a lot with the being nervous, being overly on time, because as later on we learn, he has a horrible living situation. He is sharing an apartment with 5 other guys. He's unemployed. Like, he doesn't really have any direction in his life yet. He doesn't really know what he's aiming for. Just a job at this company that is good. So I am here for him and with him. And I also feel like he is the one with the least shit that he's bringing with. Mm-hmm. And he mostly gets caught up in other people's shit without having brought the drama himself. So out of everyone in here, I felt the most sorry for him.
Yeah, he brought the trauma. He didn't bring the drama.
I didn't think he had trauma. I think that he just brought vulnerability with him because he's very young and very vulnerable. Yeah, so...
Yeah, I'm not going to say that word.
Easily exploited by Kate.
Yep. Okay, well, you say by Kate, but right now he gets slightly exploited by Beth, because Beth decides that he is the perfect candidate.
Exploited is a harsh word for this. Beth is trying to play matchmaker, and I actually really enjoy the conversation Mark and Judy have before the no one can lie anymore half.
Mm-hmm.
Because I actually feel that the two of them got along quite well.
Yeah.
Not on a romantic level, but as a rapport level.
Yeah. And this is a really interesting moment, because we have Beth sitting Mark down at the bar, and it is clear to everybody who has been there before exactly what she's doing.
This is her matchmaking chair, which I appreciate.
It is obvious to everybody except for Mark, which was his little young heart.
Baby.
And Judy comes back from the bathroom, and one of my favorite exchanges happens where Mark sees and is told that this is happening, and he feels like, well, might as well try it. And he goes, I'm Mark, by the way. And Judy goes, well, I'm gay, so...
Which also props to her to simply putting it out there, done.
But the way she says it and the way she reacts, it feels like this is not the first time people are trying to put her in a straight box.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and there is a lot of anger behind it.
She has a lot of resentment for everyone judging her, for her life, for her sexuality, for everything.
Yeah, and definitely that's not something that's gonna help her later on, if we put it mildly. At this point, while all of this is happening, Beth realizes that she hasn't taken his order, so she comes back, and he's very distracted, according to his own words. And I do not trust this, because he is very carefully listening to everything that's going on. He's people-watching. I don't like that.
He is looking for confirmation of his assumption of humanity, because keep in mind, he has been locked away for decades.
Yeah, and if you are looking for something, you usually find it.
Oh yeah, of course. But the thing is, he has been locked away for quite a while. So it's been a while that he had the interactions with people. And Rosemary actually was a really, really decent person. And so she kind of disproved his perspective and assumption upon humanity.
And he doesn't like that.
I think he needs the reconfirmation of what he needs to be true, which is that humanity is bad, that humanity needs saving, and that he is the one that is going to save the world. Because I think he has a desperate need to see himself as the good guy.
I agree. I think that he considers himself a good guy, and he just wants to be accepted as such by the society.
He needs to be a savior.
Yeah. White savior complex.
Basically, like, he wants to be the one who saves the world, because I think he has a huge inferiority complex, and to offset that. He is basically overcompensating. That nothing short of saving the world is going to confirm that he is the man, basically, you know? Mm-hmm. And learning, of course, about having Roderick as his father and everything did not help with that.
Yeah. Also, the fact that his life has been taken over and controlled by a woman, even though it was his mother, I feel like that has nurtured the need of power.
Not only that it was taken over by a woman or anything like that, because he doesn't, like, clock me. I don't clock him as a misogynist.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that, no.
He had no control over his life in general, except for the moments where he and Ruby were one. And only those moments he was in full control of his life, basically. And later when we have the nightmare that Morpheus puts him in, we even see Ethel trying to smother him as a baby, which is like, yeah. oh boy, with all the Oedipus moments in there, nearly kissing his mother and like, can we not? So yeah, poor John never had a chance, which probably is also the reason why Morpheus doesn't kill him.
Yes. So John is being distracted, and so when Beth comes up to him and asks if he wants to order something, he doesn't really know it. And halfway through the question of what would you recommend, the doorbell rings yet again. And she gets pulled away because her crowning achievement just walked into the diner.
Yes,
on their anniversary.
The matchmaking couple.
Yeah, the way this is done in the episode, I fucking love this, because they walk in and she runs over to welcome them and she says, these people are my proudest achievement. And in this moment, we get two different sides of the story.
Yeah, with Jodie repeating.
Yeah, it's the same story. It's basically the same wording, but each of them has a different color because one is told as, this is the best thing I've ever done. And the other one is, look at how pathetic it is.
Dripping sarcasm.
It is incredible. And this is one of my favorite moments that I would like to pinpoint in this episode, because just the whole framing of the situation and the way it is phrased by the both of them and the way that it is acted, it's so much and it plays so much into the theme. Mwah, loved this. Really, really loved this. And it speaks to Beth's character again.
Absolutely. But I love the whole, they all come in, they settle down, and like I was looking at all the guests that I literally wrote down. I literally hate every single guest except John.
Yeah, I don't hate the kid, Mark.
I also wasn't into him. He's the least worst of the lot of them, but...
Yeah, but no, you are correct. I do hate John as well.
Yeah, because you are you and I am me, and I have been... Team John for quite a few episodes now.
But I have to say, I do hate him less this episode because now I feel like there is more human to him.
Aww.
It's not
Look
just
at you
chaos.
Warming up for John. Warming up to John at the very end.
Careful there, careful, okay?
I'm
Let's
gonna
not
make
overdo
him fall
it.
In love with the Corinthian as well.
Hey, Corinthian hot, as long as he's wearing his glasses. I don't need teeth in my eyes. Thank you very much. Now, I feel when it comes to John, I said this last time. I remember this because the whole problem that I had with him, he was just chaos incarnate. He was unpredictable to me. I did not understand his motivations. And now in this episode, we get to learn more about his motivations by him using the ruby and the way he uses it and which direction he's taking it. We talked about him being having the savior complex. That is a big motivation that I didn't really see before that. Not this prominent. And I like this. I can appreciate this a lot more because I understand this.
I think my liking of John was strongly colored by the fact that I had listened to the audio drama.
That's
and
fair.
The diner is in the audio drama.
Nice. Very excited about the audio drama.
We actually should do like an episode on that, I feel.
We probably should.
Yeah,
now that
good
you
point. Good
say
point.
That.
Makes absolute obvious sense, but never talked about it. You're welcome, dear listeners. So she puts them, we get the whole, like, proudest achievement and everything.
So she has this proudest achievement conversation, yes. And then she starts taking their order.
Oh, God, yeah. I hated that so much that I didn't take any notes on it because it made me feel so awkward.
It is extremely awkward. And I really enjoy this on the level of learning the dynamics within the relationship.
Also, I really want to eat a double-decker now.
It sounds really, really dirty.
Oh, God. I would sit on the toilet for, like, hours, but worth it.
We get to see the dynamics between Kate and Gary. And it is not something that is very usually depicted on television. And she is trying to give him the illusion of control. And again, running into the fact that this is a lot about control, it is interesting. He loses the battle, in a sense, because he abdicates the whole idea of the double-decker. He goes with the salad because she asks him to.
Well, does she ask him to? She says, order what you like.
The illusion of control.
Ah, no, the illusion of free will.
Better. The illusion of free will. You are welcome to order whatever you want, but make sure you make the correct choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she says in a reality. So that was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Remembering the wording of what happens here, because it's going to happen again.
Which was absolutely hilarious to me. And I kind of expected them to go through a few more loops. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if he was going to keep eating the burger and then like get sick or something.
Yeah.
But sadly, we don't go there. I would have really enjoyed
that. That would be really cool. And it reminded me actually of a few different things that I have seen on television. Mm. And it is really interesting concept. Anyway, Judy talks to Mark a little bit more, and then Beth comes back and Judy reveals that Kate is the CEO of the company that Mark is about to apply for a job with. And then she has this, oh my God, I've been there. I honestly been there where you're so distracted and eaten up by things that happen. Then you're like, oh shit, that was a customer. Fuck.
Nice. Okay.
And you have to run.
And so she goes back to him and he is surprisingly chill about basically having been ignored and forgotten because he was very like taken in by everything he heard. And so he brings up a few things that he overheard. And obviously him being John, he has to do it in the most ominous possible way because he goes, you're not a waitress, you're a writer. And she goes, I'm a waitress that writes, la 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 la. And then they have this conversation like fiction, nonfiction, and her going, my characters are based on real people, but it's fiction because there's always a happy ending. And John having the perfect reply, it's because you know when to stop. Because the problem with stories is if you keep them going long enough, they all end in death. And he ain't wrong.
He's not wrong, but that doesn't mean it's not a happy ending.
That depends.
Exactly. It depends. It doesn't necessarily.
The classic happy ending is
they live happily,
ever after, and there is no death in the cliche happy ending.
Fair enough, but we as complex human beings and adult human beings and not children know that death doesn't mean a bad, unhappy
that
ending.
Ever after is not a thing.
Well, yeah, but also we can embrace death. We can die happy. I think that happy ending can be, and they died happy, you know? That can be death.
Yeah, but you always leave someone behind who will miss you. So no matter the surrounding circumstances, death always has at least a slightly sad connotation. And thus it is opposed to the happily ever after happy ending. And of course, rightfully, Beth is completely freaked out by all of this. And it just gets worse because now John basically activates the ruby.
Yeah, because she calls him handsome.
Yes, because this is now, he goes active with all of this. And I was like, okay, I hadn't realized that John's dislike of lies goes this deep. But this now is the final confirmation that this is probably why John never lies himself. Like, he lies to himself, yes, because he's still a flawed human being. But he doesn't lie to others.
And the biggest problem here is he makes people not to lie themselves either.
Mm-hmm.
So if we kept it external,
this actually would have been nice because the first iteration actually works really, really well. And only once shitteth has hitteth the fenneth, it goes really bad.
My notes.
Did you write down the shitteth has hitteth the fenneth?
No, just hitteth the fenneth. But in a little bit later. But yes, feels like if you keep it external, it is tough and it can get dicey. But as long as you keep the illusion of lying to yourself, you can survive it.
It actually worked out really well because later on, the three couples, for a moment, seem decently happy, you know?
Yeah.
A quick escape from the annoying, harsh reality.
They all kind of get what they're looking for at the moment.
Exactly. They get the validation that they needed in that moment. And then everyone could have just moved on with their life and never come back to the diner again because it would have been very awkward.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But sadly, we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. We go back into the entire diner with all the characters and we have more interaction of the couple. And I literally wrote down, why are these two married? They obviously hate each other.
Yeah, there is a lot of things for the show where Gary has clearly an issue with Kate, not with Kate calling him fat or bringing up whatever, but doing that in front of Beth. That's the issue that he has.
He has a very fragile masculinity and he doesn't respond well to Kate controlling what he does in front of other people.
So, yes, I have written down there's a lot wrong with that marriage. There's a certain desire in this. This is going to circle kind of towards the end of the episode because
really?
I think I have no way to confirm this, but I think that that was desire.
What other D could it
because
be?
Because this is what I wrote desire, but didn't connect it with the person at the end. But now I'm connecting it. I'm doing the thing.
Ooh, we're watching it unfold in Vero's mind.
This is why it's a bit rough around the edges.
That's what he said.
A lot of what's happening in the diner, specifically in the next, say, 10 minutes, is about desire and following the desires honestly.
Yeah, what you actually want and then just going for
it. And just going for it, exactly. I feel it would make sense for the sibling that shows up at the end to be desire because this kind of draws them to the diner, essentially, in my opinion. Mm. So, you know, just a thought. I don't know if you, do you know who that is at
yes.
the end? Okay. So, like, to me, it's a very, kind of a situation. And this seems like the most obvious choice at this point, anyway. Then we slightly move over to Judy, who is trying to text Donna.
Yes.
In her opinion, which is a bit naive, her texts aren't going through. We get a little droplet of honesty from Mark. And this is where, in my opinion, it's starting to hit the funnest for the first time. Because we realize at this point that they can't leave. Because Judy says, fuck you, grabs her stuff and starts aiming for the door. And before she walks through it, she stops. And we don't know why. There is no other reason than John.
We do not get any kind of explanation, even later on, with when the loop for the couple happens.
Yeah.
It's slightly different than I remember it in the audio drama.
Uh-huh.
So I was very curious when that happened.
Yeah. So I would love to know, I feel like John is just trying to kind of create his test group here in the diner.
He does not allow more changes to the applicants. And so he has picked his characters and now all of them have to stay.
A study group, I called it in my notes.
I was so freaked out by the fact that John moved seats.
That was so creepy.
And it happens again afterwards. And I was just like, how? That was so fucking scary. Like, seriously, I think it's one of the scariest things in the episode. John just suddenly sitting somewhere else.
I was like, what is happening? And then my only response to that was, Ruby, blah, blah.
Fair enough. This is also when the storm outside really starts picking up and everything. I was like, of course there is a storm. And like we said in one of our other bits, we're going to have to put this on the question list if all the outside changes with the accidents and everything are also caused by the
Ruby. Basically, we don't have the confirmation or even anything audible, I don't think, coming from the radio or from the telly at this point, but we're going to get it soon. But Judy starts sharing.
Yeah, oh God. And I liked her less and less by every single sentence that she says.
Yeah, this is, it's a lot. Because she says, I hope she's all right, because she's worried about her.
And John goes, do you? And she goes like, no, of course not. I hope she's been in a car accident. I'm like, okay, fuck you.
Well, I can see where this is coming from because...
Yes, me too, but also fuck you. No.
Yeah, I mean, no, but... Especially with the knowledge of what happened last night.
Exactly.
But it's the last straw when we are trying to reach somebody and they're not responding. It could either be their choice. We don't want that to be their choice, which is what's happening with Judy. So she's looking for excuses. Maybe she was in a car accident.
The thing is, I literally had a random Tinder dude who got very obsessed barrage me with messages. And one of those messages were like, basically, have you hit a tree with your car, or worse, do you not want to talk to me anymore? And so I'm very fucking...
Yeah, no, I can see that.
Because real life example.
Very fair. Mm-hmm. To me, this was very human, very fallible.
Yep, doesn't change that it's incredibly creepy. And
it is fucked, yeah. Then she goes, I get jealous. And then
and
she continues.
Angry.
Well, angry is what John says. She says, no, I get jealous.
Mm-hmm. Because she's still lying to herself.
And then she says, everyone here is judging me. I don't like to be judged. Because she feels like she's being judged by John. Why? Because she is judging herself.
Exactly. No one is actually judging
her.
Well,
except for Beth.
The thing is, I don't think Beth is actually judging her, because we have this other moment, I don't remember when it is exactly, when we learn that Beth doesn't think that Donna is good enough for Judy. So it is not that Beth is judging Judy for her sexuality, but that she thinks that she could do so much better.
But does she can do so much better mean if she only dated a man?
I don't know. I just think Beth is not a fan of Donna, and that is fair
enough.
That
is fair enough. I also think that John is judging her, just not for the reasons that Judy thinks.
Yeah, John is judging everyone.
Exactly.
Doesn't make her special that John is judging her. He's judging everyone.
Well, let's just say that she is hyper-focused on judgment right now, because she is judging herself.
And we switch over to the pair, which is also trying to leave. And then we have the already several times alluded loop that is now starting, because they try to leave, turn around. Beth is like, oh, welcome back. Happy anniversary. And it's very obvious instantly that delete, rinse and repeat. And so they sit down. And once again, we get the food order thingy. And once again, he will get the burger.
This is also where we get a little new snippet from the television about the storm, where the person on the telly says there is a storm and hails come in, which is not unusual for this time of the year. However, it's coming from the north instead of coming from the south, where all the weather was coming from originally. So it's coming from an unusual site. What that means, I do not know, but something is happening. I actually really love the concept of using the same dialogue framed into a different context, because it is extremely creepy, but extremely cool.
Yeah. And then, of course, we move on to the next stage, because Beth really loves to meddle, and she mentions that this lovely young man is in a diner who has an interview at Vanguard. And Kate, I think mostly just to be contrary to Gary, is like, sure, let's do the interview right here. And gets Mark to sit down next to her, which also was so good.
I think the reason she has him down, did you notice that? Because she takes the phone away from Gary when he says he's got a text from shipping, which is something that she didn't do before, because she was lying to herself, trying to trust that he is not texting with the woman.
I think she already knew.
I mean, she knew, but she didn't want to see it, I feel like.
Yeah, and because John now has removed the ability to lie to yourself.
She takes the phone and she looks at it and she sees, and then her, in my eyes, revenge for that is inviting Mark to sit next to her.
I'm not sure if she saw something on the phone, but I think it's very clear that she already knows that Gary has been fucking around, which... maybe just have the fucking conversation, people. Be fucking grown-ups.
Yeah.
But so yeah, they sit down, and my expectation was very different for the interview, because having to do a job interview when you cannot lie seemed very daunting, you know? But the interview actually goes surprisingly well later on. But before we go into the interview, we pop over into the kitchen.
So this scene was
painful.
The most uncomfortable for me to watch from the entire episode.
Okay.
Because it was taking twists and turns that I did not see coming. And it was taking a lot worse turns than I expected. Let's face that. Because I have said that earlier. My assumption or guess was there's already been something going on, and she has some difficult news for him, rather than I want to pursue this for the first time properly. And boy, that's just unexpectedly gruesome. And poor Beth, I feel bad for her.
The thing is, I thought this was going to be so much worse. And then when we learned that the son is 21, I was so okay it because wasn't as bad as I thought it'd be.
I was very worried when he mentions this because I know that they mentioned that...
That he's off to college.
He's off to college, but that means nothing to me because I'm not American. And to me, exactly. That's not a clear age bracket.
In my brain, he could have been 16 or something.
Exactly.
And I was like...
When he first says, I go to your son's room, even the way this is phrased, I was
the sentence by itself is so gross.
I was grasping to my seat. I was like, this is not something that I want to hear. Oh,
yeah,
yikes.
That was bad. That was really bad.
But then it brings me to something that Beth says. She says, Bernard doesn't speak when you're not there. Does that mean he may be on a spectrum or disabled in some way? Because that would bring it.
No, he just doesn't like his mom. He's only coming home to fuck the dude.
Okay, thank you. Because
moody,
I was like...
old teenager, basically, that has to come home during college break. And he only comes home because it's where... his room is, and he only stays there because he has to. And when Marsh is there, he at least has a reason to interact with someone. And when it's just his mom, he's an asshole. Because it's also asshole behavior to hook up with the dude that your mom is very obviously into.
Okay.
So I don't like Bernard.
This made me more comfortable with the situation. Because even though he is quite young, he is of legal age, whatever, I was very uncertain about that part. Because the way this could be phrased, it could be worse.
Like I said, it all of this could have been so much worse. And because it isn't, it lost a lot of the effect it had right afterwards. And I'm quite thankful for that because
I didn't need to have that on screen.
We go back into the main area of the diner where John has moved again. And yeah, I did not like that. Mark himself seems pretty self-aware in this entire interview process, which I appreciated and just... confirmed to me that Mark is actually the best bean here. He has sad circumstances. He is trapped in a situation that he should not be trapped in. He's not a regular in this diner. He just happens upon this. He just has shit timing. And he actually doesn't really lie that much to either himself or the people around him.
The reason why I said trauma earlier is because of the one sentence that he drops here. And that is, can you please say that to my mother?
Yeah, because his mom is a normal mom that wants her son to be successful and have a pretty girl as a friend and everything.
Well, not every girl needs taken care of. Can you say that to my mother? Because it feels like he has been told that he's not good enough. That's why I said trauma. Baggage would be a better word for it.
It's a classic thing. You need to be successful as a man. Like, all of this is just a classic toxic masculinity bullshit. I wouldn't go as far and label it as trauma.
Like, that's why I'm like, baggage would be probably a better...
Baggage. What human doesn't have?
Yeah, true.
Also, I didn't realize that the husband wasn't at the table anymore during the interview.
Oh, really?
So I was very confused about how candid some of this conversation was. I was like, is the husband not listening anymore? Also, is the interview going to... is it more about Mark being the replacement for Gary? Which then, right in the kitchen scene, gets confirmed that yes, basically, he is auditing for that. But I was like, where's Gary? What? And then okay.
Well, we learn yet again that things between Kate and Gary are a lot about control. And it's they are a lot worse than you could have guessed at the beginning of the episode, yes.
Because in the beginning you think it's just sugar mama and boy toy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out, no, so much more.
And Marsh says, which kind of sounds interesting from him, about Mark, he's just a kid.
Yeah.
Okay, my dude. And Gary goes, so was I.
Which, creepy predatory behavior by Kate.
Trophy husband.
The so was I caused me to go like, oh, Gary also seems more self-aware than I thought. Maybe I like Gary. And that was the end of the kitchen scene for
me. So now John is watching what's going on and they're all paired off.
Yes, we have Judy and Beth, we have Mark and Kate, and we have Marsh and Gary.
Yes, so Beth is no longer actively working. Kate is coming on to Mark, and Gary has this whole speech.
About sometimes you have to get your dick sucked.
He'll get to that.
how the speech ends that he starts now, and the entire speech was just like very... I stopped liking him very quickly.
Yeah. He goes, she gave me everything not because she loves me, but so I don't leave, so she's not alone, and she appears lovable, which she is not.
Which, fuck you, dude. Neither of you.
Then he goes, when I'm with her, I'm a good boy. When I'm not, I'm pretty bad. And then the just like...
The entire thing gave me the ick.
They just should not be together.
Yeah.
This is the moment when it becomes very, very clear where this is going. Even the kind of unexpected Gary being very open with his sexuality.
I think Gary doesn't care who sucks his dick as long as someone is sucking his dick.
This is how he phrases it, and this is why he phrases it this way, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
But we get the whole Kate and Mark, Gary and Marsh, but we also have suddenly this whole Judy and Beth situation where Beth says, I don't like her for you specifically. Yeah. And that seems like a very obvious phrasing of I like me for you, which is interesting because I didn't see that from her thus far.
I think Beth also doesn't care that much about who likes her as long as they like her.
Exactly.
Which is so sad. To me, Beth is the saddest character out of all of them.
Yeah. This is a moment where John starts walking around the diner and it's all one shot.
Yeah.
And it's so beautifully done.
But it's also so creepy.
Oh, incredibly. But the neon is giving a reddish light to everything. And the song that plays is called Red Comes in Many Shades by US Girls.
Ooh, nice.
I found that so good. It was a very, very good choice. And it's one of the first moments when I actively noticed a song without it being the Sandman tune.
Because the theme of the Sandman is a lot in this episode, like way more than the previous few episodes.
Yeah, but this specific song is very out there. And because it's connected to the walk in single shot around the diner, with the couples being in the background and John going into the kitchen. Oof.
Did you instantly realize what he's getting? Because it took me way too long.
I was convinced it was a big bucket of mayonnaise. And I was like, why?
I was so confused that he was getting anything. I was like, what the fuck could he even be getting? And then I realized it's ice cream. I was like, oh my God. Really, John?
Yeah, I had to stop the episode to see what's written on the bucket. Because I was like, this looks exactly like the gigantic bucket of mayonnaise that we use at work.
Ugh.
And I just...
Nice.
It's... Just
love me some, like, mayo.
It would still work for me if it was mayo.
Just because John is so gross.
Yes, absolutely. But with the, you know, red light being very significant as well when it comes to certain establishments, it just all was brought together in a way that I was like, this is so well done.
Yeah, visually, this is definitely one of my favorite episodes and moments in this episode so far, because I was struggling the last two episodes and I'm back, which I think has been very apparent because I have not been complaining a single time this episode.
In this moment, I was like, well, according to this experiment, when we are honest with each other and ourselves, we just want to fuck.
Yeah, like I was with the everyone has their dramas and their failures and shortcomings and everything, but no one is like truly, truly evil or horrible in that sense. And now we have three new couples that are down to fuck, which I did not see coming. But it's also so much more positive than anything I would have expected. And I kind of feel that John is not okay with that. And I think this is a moment where he cheats. Because once everything is done, it's, to me, completely suddenly escalates. And there is a disconnect to me, because to me, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all. And the only explanation I could think of is that John cheated to get the outcome that he wants,
that he expects,
and that he wants it. He needs it. He needs confirmation that humanity is flawed and bad and evil, and that he needs to be saving it. And I was just
because it
like,
feels
what?
Extremely hypocritical of
yes!
Gary to attack Mark. And
why
I
is
didn't
he suddenly
feel...
jealous? It makes no sense.
It felt out of character for him because he wasn't interested in Kate that way. And he watched it happen before that. He could have stopped it way before that, before it got this far.
Yeah. He literally said that he doesn't want to fuck her and that she doesn't want to be fucked. So it made zero sense to me. And the only explanation I can come up with is that John cheated because they did not prove him right.
Yeah.
Because while flawed, they didn't completely suck. And they actually were good for each other.
Yeah, I suppose. Now, we also get a little detail of Rose, Judy's friend, calling back and Judy not picking up. And because I'm a nosy bitch, I would love to know what was the information that Rose is calling back with.
My assumption is that she made contact with Donna and learned that Judy had hit Donna and called Judy to go eat glass and not bother.
I feel like if I found something out like this, I would either text or not bother to contact them again.
No, I would basically watch, look them in the eye and be like, fuck you, suck, and don't you ever dare reach out to me again.
Yeah, very different people we are.
Really? How are you surprised by that?
Not at all. Now, another thing, this whole situation gets broken up by
Gary.
A promotion outside by Gary attacking Mark. And I was just really, as you said, confused why, what's going on there. Because as I usually do, I watched it twice. And the first time I kind of watched it and I was like, this is okay, whatever. And I'm going to make notes when I come back to it. And then as I was coming up to it, to the point in the rewatch, I was thinking to myself, I must have missed something watching it the first time because I don't remember what caused this.
Yeah.
And there needs to be a reason for this because...
Why?
And there's nothing. There is nothing. So yes, I agree with you. It's a really good explanation that John cheated.
Yeah, because otherwise this would not have turned into the situation that he needed, and he needed all of them to fucking die.
Yeah.
Then have, of course, Mark struggling, and I was rooting for Mark, and I am very here for the fact that Mark literally stabs Gary in self-defense in the throat. So I was like, go Mark, go Mark. Even though I'm very sad that at the end he cuts off his hand and bleeds to death.
There is a lot of things in that sequence that I was struggling with. But in this point, I was pissed off at Kate as well, because Kate's like all over Gary. I'm like, oh no, let's call an ambulance. Like, honey, ambulance ain't gonna help him. He did.
I think Kate is very much overwhelmed by the situation.
Yeah, whatever. So she's human.
Wow. Wow. Dear listeners, it is a shame you could not see Vero's facial expression that went along with this. Wow, I wish I would have been able to take a screenshot right there. Wow, so much disdain for a fictional character.
I'm not gonna lie, Kate's not my favorite.
Everything escalates and Bette is the one that is like, wait, you are doing this. And I am here for Bette being the most aware one, because even now when everything starts and people start hurting themselves in various ways and actually actively killing themselves, Bette is the one that survives the longest. And once again, she then walks up to John, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was here for her being the strongest mentally, I would say. But I also do not understand at all why everyone is now starting to kill themselves. Why?
So there's this whole speech that John has.
Yeah.
He essentially prompts them to enjoy their own suffering.
He basically says that their suffering will set them free, that it will save them. So I would have understood if they started to hurt themselves, but they're going in for the kill. Kate literally cuts her throat. That is not suffering. That is straight up death.
Yes.
And I did not understand that.
I think Kate's one is the most harsh one, the most final one, the fastest one. This whole segment made me extremely uncomfortable.
Yeah, rightfully so. It's incredibly gruesome. Once they are fully done, Bette walks up to John with her burnt hands and is basically like, what the fuck is going on? Why are you doing this to us? And it doesn't, you said it would save us. The suffering would save us. It doesn't. And he says, because you're still looking at it through your own eyes. You're still seeing it with your eyes. And she does, in my opinion, the most horrifying thing I've seen in quite a bit when it comes to TV shows. Because she pierces both of her eyeballs at the same time, which blinding herself.
And basically killing herself because she stabs really, really deep. So I I'm assuming it goes directly into her brain.
Probably. But now we have three dead females, and that gives us my favorite moment in the episode, and that is the Fates showing up, using the three dead bodies and flickering through. And just like the Fates do the three sisters, sister one, sister sibling, sister self, or whatever it was, sister self was the, as the sister selves thingy that they did with the switching around, they do it with the three dead women. And we get three different futures, and we get you come from dust and you return to dust, which is everybody's future. We get no future for you. The skein of your life is cut, son of your mother. Do you know what a skein is?
No.
A skein is a length of yard, loosely coiled and knotted. Because I didn't know that. So, no future for you. The skein of your life is cut, son of your mother. Which, yes, son of your mother, like that. And once again, John isn't satisfied with that. And so he gets, you will crush the Dream Lord's life in your hands. Which, in my opinion, leads up to John breaking the ruby, thinking that this is what is going to kill Dream.
Save him.
And without the Fates telling him that, he might not have thought of this. So in some way, the Fates save Morpheus's life.
Yeah, in a way. But they do what they do best. They reply in a riddle.
Yeah, but I do wonder why they even show up at all.
I was thinking about this, and I feel like there is so much sacrifice happening around John at this point. And them showing up wakes Dream up as well. So I feel like there is a certain disturbance and it draws them in.
But I don't see that self-sacrifice or pain or suffering or anything of that is connected to the Fates, you know? It makes no sense to me that they show up. I love that they show up, but I don't understand why. And that is like my main setting in this episode. I'm so confused, but I'm happily confused.
Yeah.
Usually I'm complaining when I'm confused, but I'm enjoying being confused because for once, I have no idea what the fuck is going on.
Yep, honestly, same.
So, ominous shit, three futures, and this transitions us into the doors opening, and we have Enter the Dream! And obviously, I have to instantly complain, why is he not wearing his helmet?
Because he doesn't want it, I guess.
Yeah, no, I hate it. I hate it. I love that later on he's fucking wearing it. But yeah, I know Morpheus gotta be pretty. Can he please wear his fucking helmet?
I, in this point, am very angry with John.
Really?
No, because like he does all of this shit and then a new person arrives and he doesn't realize it's Morpheus straight away. He goes, glad you're here. Power's gone out. There's no TV and no one left to talk to. And I'm like, well, whose fucking fault is that?
Yeah, John's grasp on reality is
gone.
I was gonna say fragile at best.
I feel like at this point it's full-on disintegrated.
But then Dream says something to him, and in that moment, John realizes that this is the Sandman, which obviously reminded me of our first episode when you didn't know who the Sandman was. I'm still not over that fact. It gave me so much joy. It was so fucking funny. I love that.
I still need to do a full-on sit-down and figure out in the mythology, where is it coming from and why?
We do that after we cover the season, I think.
Fine.
Just in case it spoilers anything within this season.
Mr. Sandman, give me a dream.
Exactly. And so we start having the interaction. And here once again, we see that John genuinely believes that he is doing good, that he is saving the world. Which, of course, evil people rarely are aware that they are evil and doing bad things, but he is delusional to a level that excuses a lot of his behavior to me, because like Morpheus later on says, it came into your possession by no fault of your own.
Yeah.
We had this conversation last episode or two episodes ago. He never had a chance. And so it was really good for me to see, to get a sort of, not redemption, but yes, he is evil and yes, he's fucked up, but it's also okay to forgive him.
It is a really good payoff, this episode. I'm not gonna lie. I noticed that for some reason, and I'm not really sure why that is, John constantly refers to dreams as lies.
Yeah. Okay, that was obvious to me, because in the Lucifer episode, we have the equation of hope and dream. And here again, we get the equation of hope and dream. And if dreams and hopes are the same, hopes are lies to someone who doesn't have hope.
So you think that John is the only human in the world who does not have a sliver of hope?
And I think that makes him incredibly miserable. And I think that is why he is the way he is, because there is no hope in his life and there has never been.
That's terrible.
And in a way he is right, because hoping is a way of lying to yourself in finding out what might be a good outcome of something positive that might come to pass, and then believing it will come true. And that is, in a certain sense, lying to yourself, because you can't know. That's the point of hope. You cannot know if it's actually going to work out. And I think that maybe as a child, John did hope for things and they didn't come to pass. And then the ruby helped him realize that lying to yourself and lying to others just makes everything so much worse. And if you abandon all hope and simply accept everything as it is, you basically reduce the amount of chance to get hurt. So
yeah,
you close off your heart.
Exactly.
Yeah, of course. And I'm not saying it's positive or anything, but to me it made a lot of sense that the Lord of Dreams is the Lord of Hope, which makes him the Lord of Lies in John's point of view.
This is the whole moment, and what you just said fits very much perfectly with this, because they're standing in the diner that is filled with mutilated bodies.
Yeah.
This is the reality that John sees. And Dream stands there and says, this is the reality if you take away their hope, if you take away their dreams.
This is the truth of mankind.
But not with it. This is the truth of these people, is these dreams. And this is how they want to live their life. And if you take that away, of course, this is going to be the harsh reality.
Because then only despair and death exist. If you take Dream away, you are left with death and despair.
So now we have this, if I look at it from this perspective, and after you explained it to me, what feels like spoon-fed explanation of what has been happening for the last couple of episodes, but I am so happy for it, because I wouldn't have gotten it otherwise. I needed this very obvious and clear to my eyes metaphor and comparisons and everything in order to understand John in the first place. And it genuinely makes me like him more.
Which I think is why it's being framed like that. And it also, in retrospect, gives more context to the Lucifer episode with where would all the souls be without dreams? Because we see where humans are, and the souls of humans down in hell, if they didn't have hopes and dreams, they also would just give up.
Yeah. Also, I love that Dream walks into this with not the energy of, I need the ruby back, give it back to me, but he comes in with, John, the ruby is hurting you.
Yeah.
It was not made to be used by a human.
Yeah.
That's a very, very big difference to me.
Here, once again, we have the retrospect relevance of the episode with John Constantine. Because had Dream still the mindset of all humans are Roderick, he would not have been able to come into this moment with kindness. And he does approach John with kindness. And so we needed the, for me, very exhausting episode with John Constantine for Dream to relearn...
Joanna.
Oh, sorry. With Joanna. Yes. for Dream to relearn kindness towards humans. And so all of these episodes, obviously, have been building up to this one. And yes, it's not surprising, but it works really, really well. And as exhausting and as exasperated I was in some of these episodes, it all led to this, and it all makes a lot of sense. And I'm really, really into this. And now we go into something else that I didn't really understand. Because John goes, if I kill you, then I will be the new king. And Morpheus goes, if you try to kill the Dream Lord, you should do it in his realm. And I thought, okay, yeah, we're going to go into the dreaming because this is where Morpheus has the most power, right? This is why we're going there. And then he just straight up completely fails and fucks up and everything. And I'm like, huh?
I think there is a different reason for them to go into the dreaming.
Okay, tell me.
I think it's because Dream needs to take John away from Earth. He needs to take him away from humans so he can't hurt anymore.
So basically that the interaction that we have in the dreaming does have no further negative effects on humanity, which would feed into your theory that everything outside of the diner is also being affected by John and the ruby.
Yes.
Because if that theory is true, then it makes more sense. If it is just a diner, it makes no sense because they're already all dead.
Yes.
So I was like, okay, if it doesn't give you like a power up, Morpheus, why? So yeah, but we go into the dreams. And did you instantly recognize Roderick's house?
I didn't on the outside. Only when we get inside, I was like, oh, of course.
I instantly recognized it. It was like, hi, daddy. We're going, because come on. And we go full Oedipus. We go full fucking Oedipus in this. It is hilarious to me. It is incredibly awkward. I hate it. Oedipus is one of the worst Greek tales. Mm-hmm. Well, do not enjoy that. And at some point, he realizes it's a dream when he's being choked and he's realizing he's actually choking himself, which I should not be doing because then I have to cough.
Maybe that's why Dream wanted to bring him to Dreamings as well, because he could have used the actual dreams to get to him if John didn't realize that he is actually in a dream.
To me, it was a very weak effort.
Yeah, a little bit.
The moment John realizes where we are basically transported scene-wise into the palace, into the cathedral, that looks so much more amazing than I remember it, despite being completely broken down. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the moments, or I think this is the moment where he calls him King of Lies.
Yep, and I bet it is.
I was here for it, and this is also the moment Dream then does fully show up, and he is wearing his helmet. And obviously me having been harping on about the fact that he needs to wear his fucking helmet, I was like, yeah, finally!
Like it's helping him at all.
Sadly, then I instantly realized why he's wearing it, because it's easier for the special effect. So,
okay, I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, because you have the special effect around his form, and when you do not have to mimic the facial feature, it's easier for the special effects team. Because, I mean, later on when we have ginormous Morpheus and Tiny John, it looks so uncanny, it's horrifying. So I feel like they should have left the helmet on, which they can't, because taken straight from the comics. The moment of Morpheus holding John in his hand is an exact replica from a comic page.
I've seen that picture.
And so I understand why we couldn't leave the helmet on, because that would not have been nice to the comic fans. And so while all of this is happening, I was like, this has to be a trick, right? Morpheus is actively tricking John into doing something, and he's not. I was so confused. I was so fucking confused.
I was like, why is he not being like better at this?
Yeah, he's such a fuck up. He's so incompetent. He's such a weakling. I'm sorry. I really hope that changes.
This time, I actually agree with you. However, it kind of makes sense, because he does say
the ruby took more of his energy,
which means that he is weaker than he was at the beginning.
Yeah, I know. Basically, all of Gregory went into the ruby, all the power he took back.
Basically.
Yeah.
Maybe even more. So he really didn't have much of a choice. He just needed to try.
Which is why I thought it was a deliberate trickery. But no, when John breaks the ruby, Morpheus later says, thank you for doing that. I'd never thought of that. Which is why, huh? How did you not think of this? Lucifer straight up told you that you have been too dependent on your tools. You should have realized that destroying the ruby is the smartest thing to do if you can't change it back to you. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, did we like literally get this fucking close to Morpheus losing?
Apparently. But the thing is, right? I wonder, and this is something that John also says, he calls the dreaming his birthright. It feels like he is trying to not just kill the dream, but become him, because he's trying to take his power.
He says so. If I kill you, will I be the new you, basically.
In that case, that means, though, that dreaming cannot be destroyed, in a way. So maybe Morpheus wanted to see if the dreaming would protect him, but maybe he would just cease to exist as the Dream Lord and John would now become a new one.
I don't think so, because John genuinely thinks that he destroyed the dreaming and Morpheus, because in the beginning when he's on the palm, it is completely white around him.
Yeah.
It's the nothingness, basically. And so I don't think that the dreaming or dreams would survive if Morpheus dies. But so we have this whole reveal with John being tiny in the palm and Morpheus explaining that he hadn't realized how much power he put in this, which is a callback to how dependent you get on the tools from Lucifer, and that he has now all his power back. So they better make him more competent in the next episodes, because I am over him being a weak-ass baby.
Mm-hmm.
we have this interaction, which of course has to be filmed very only face shot, because we cannot have too much of Tiny John and Ginormous Morpheus. But I love the facial expressions of John. I mean, I've made no secret that I love the actor. And this just, it was very satisfying to me how his end is being done and everything. So I was really, really here for it. And yeah. I loved it.
It was beautiful to watch, but also it felt like kind of short.
Rushed.
Interaction, slightly rushed.
But for Morpheus to have that much empathy for a human is already a lot of growth.
Oh, yeah.
Because John asks him, are you going to kill me? And then Morpheus says, it came into your possession by no fault of your own, so I don't think I will. And then we move over back into the real world.
Well, so he places him on the bed.
Yeah, we are in the asylum, and he lies him down with this really gentle, caring energy.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yes. And one moment I thought he'd kiss him on the forehead.
It was so close, right?
Right? Sleep well, John.
Is this an upside down crucifix above his bed?
No, it's a microphone.
Okay.
It's to record sounds.
Okay. Because I wasn't sure, because it kind of looked it.
In the first moment, it looked like it. No, it's in the middle of the room and it's directional microphones to pick up sound.
That makes a lot more sense.
At least that's what I saw, so.
Okay, well, we'll see anyway, I suppose.
We go outside.
Go into the streets.
With burning garbage cans, which give more credence to your theory. And we have the interaction with Matthew, which, who cares?
Nah.
Morpheus goes that rebuilding starts tomorrow, but for tonight, humanity will sleep in peace. While they walk off, the camera turns around and there's a strange person we haven't met before, but that strange person says Big Brother. Ooh. Mm-hmm. So who do you think it is?
I think, and I said this earlier this episode, I don't know if it made it in, I think this is Desire.
Okay.
Because it's the only D that makes sense to me right now. But the only reason for this is the episode.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't it death? There was so much death in this episode.
Because they say Big Brother, and death is the biggest of them all.
You think so?
So I think that this sibling needs to be smaller than dreams and death.
Okay, and why isn't it despair? Because we literally talked about without dream, there's only death and despair.
It could be, but I genuinely think desire makes more sense to me within the happenings of this episode.
Okay, good, good, good. Just wanted to inquire.
Yeah.
Because I already know who that is.
Okay,
mka. With that all done and wrapped up, what do I have to say about this episode? Non-surprising, the most important thing I have to say is boo, no more John. So that makes me very sad and I will miss him. And I really do hope that we get more Corinthian in the next episode so I can have my other fix, you know? If I can't have my sweet Bibba John, then at least I can have my hot Samaritan Corinthian. Vero is looking utterly disgusted with me. I love it. What an episode. I am mostly confused by it. And I think we talked about this at length. Given how long the recording ended up this time, I think most of it is going to make it into the episode. And I am very curious where we go from here. I did enjoy myself despite my confusion. So that was surprising to me, because usually if it is confusing to me, I do not take well to that. Because how can it be that me not understanding something that means the writing must be wrong? If you've listened to our previous episodes, you know that sometimes I am failing to that, you know? So, yes, I hope we continue on the path of happy confusion. I hope we continue on the path of a more competent dream. And I hope to see some hot Corinthian and some beep, because I don't want to spoiler who that character is.
Okay. As some of you may have guessed by now, I loved this episode.
Really?
I know, it's shocking. The ending didn't really grip me as much as I hoped, because it did feel a little simple and rushed, considering how high John was built up as the villain and how dangerous he was for Dream.
He was a mini-boss, you know?
Yeah, clearly, clearly. I did expect Dream to struggle a bit more to get where he is now, considering how intense John was as the villain, mini boss, whatever. But the truth is, in the end, John was only human. Anyway, the rest of the episode felt like it could have been a play on stage, which is something that I really love when it's done on television. And there were certain turns that I did not expect, which is one of my favorite things. Also, there was Daisy Head, which I also love very much. And in general, getting a little tease of humanity without dreams was very, very intense. I do find it extremely interesting in connotation with what Dream said to Lucifer in the last episode, and we've mentioned that before. Also, I am extremely intrigued by which D is currently watching Dream.
I love the which D phrasing of that.
Mm-hmm. And with that, we say thank you for listening. And please do follow us on our social media. You can find us on Twitter, Blue Sky, or Instagram. Or you can email us your thoughts and ideas and questions to...
Or your complaints.
Or your complaint. Sandman or the Sandman?
Sandman.
Sandman at taot-podcast.com.
If you want to be like Alex, who we did already shout out this episode, and support us on a special level, you can become a Patreon over at patreon.com/taotpodcast. There are 3 levels for you. Either you believe in us or you just support us, and we are happy with both, to be honest. There are perks that you can check out there, and if you are a believer, you get so many hours of bonus content that you will probably never catch up if you actually get started on it. Also, there's a Discord where currently it's a bit quiet. During Good Omens, it was incredibly active, so let's see how it goes in the future. If you don't want to do that, the one thing you totally should do is force all your friends to listen, because then you can talk to them about the episodes and side with either Vero or me, which you obviously have to do.
Side with me? Absolutely, yes, yeah, you have to do that. Yeah.
And then once you've done this, please do consider writing us a review on iTunes, because to this day, this is still the most important place where you get traction for your podcast. So be kind to us. Thanks. Bye.